content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, earthen rivers are flowing through the West scorched forests by Kylie Moore. 2 Septembers ago, the residents of Grotto, Washington, woke to the Bolt Creek fire ripping the mountains above their homes. "This doesn't happen here," Patricia Vasquez remembers saying at the time, shocked. Though areas east of the state's Cascade Mountains frequently burn in the summer, Grotto is on the mountain's west side in a wetter climate, where fires have been infrequent but are becoming more common. Vasquez evacuated with her husband, Lorenzo, their dog, Ava, and the fresh Alaska halibut they'd just caught while on vacation. Elizabeth Walther, their neighbor, evacuated with a puppy, but her husband, Richard, a ski patroller, stayed behind to hose down the house. No one died and no houses burned, but wildfire survivors in Washington now face a new threat: debris flows. Wildfires can lessen the soil's ability to absorb water, so when thunderstorms, rapid snow melt, atmospheric rivers, or rain falling on snow occur in a burned area, that can create a roaring earthen river. Debris flows can move quickly, 30 miles per hour or more, sliding from the uplands to the valley floor in a matter of minutes. Debris flows are more dangerous than mudslides and slower-moving landslides. They can sweep away boulders, trees, and cars and threaten everything in their path, including roads and homes and the people who live in them. Last year in Washington's Okanogan County, 2 residents were rescued from their home after earth flowed through a burn scar. Another flow destroyed a cabin and sent a foot of water and mud into at least 30 structures. And in 2018, 23 people were killed when heavy rains triggered a debris flow in the burn scar of Southern California's Thomas Fire. United States Geological Survey, USGS, modeling indicates that for perhaps the next several years, there's a high probability of debris flows in the mountains above Grotto and other communities along the South Fork of the Skykomish River Corridor. The USGS models were originally created using data from drier areas in the West, where debris flows have been happening for years after fires, and may be less accurate in Washington's wet climate, particularly on the rainier side of the Cascade Range. Until recently, there's been little research on how post-fire debris flows behave in Washington. One May afternoon, 8 months after the fire, a team of researchers made their way up a soot-blackened hillside a few miles from Grotto. Ashy dirt crunched underfoot as they scrambled over and around trees that had been toppled by the fire. They were looking for the right tree to mount a game camera on in order to document future debris flows. They also wanted to check on the rain gauges they'd installed last fall, not long after the fire, when rainy weather and still smoldering stumps made setting up the equipment extra tricky. The Washington Geological Survey's wildfire-associated landslide emergency response team is tracking recently burned sites in the state to understand when landslides occur and how much precipitation it takes to trigger them. The missing piece is the exact time. Kate Mickelson, a geologist, says the weather patterns, geography, and vegetation of the Pacific Northwest are different from California's, and these variations can influence when the earth slides. In the Northwest, for example, debris flows can occur several years after a fire, but in California they usually happen in the first 2 rainy seasons that follow. Generally, the National Weather Service debris flow warnings are triggered if a quarter inch of rain falls in 15 minutes or if 1 inch falls in an hour, Mickelson said. Sometimes they're issued for at least the first 2 years post-fire, either countywide or just for the area near a burn scar. The warning system's thresholds can be tweaked to reflect the region. But in rainy parts of western Washington, heavy rain is not unusual, and scientists fear that issuing alerts all the time could numb people to the danger, making them less likely to evacuate. After 15 minutes of hiking, the researchers found the perfect location for their camera, a standing tree perched just above a likely flow path, a few feet up on a mound of rocks. Finding the right spot is tricky. The tree must be close enough to the debris flow for it to trigger the camera to record, but not so close that the tree and camera get swept away. Mickelson and the geoscientist Amelia Richard wrapped a strap around the tree's trunk and mounted a solar-powered camera facing south, then took a few test pictures to make sure it was properly angled. Game cameras, rain gauges, and other tools can help scientists understand how much precipitation it takes to trigger debris flows in western Washington and help the USGS fine-tune its modeling. Mickelson's team had set up cameras in 5 and rain gauges in 11 recent burn scars around the state. In some locations, they also installed pressure transducers, devices that measure the water's pressure on the earth. The devices are drilled into bedrock and can sense the rapid increases in pressure caused by debris flow. When the researchers returned in May to install the camera, they also checked on their other equipment. Luckily, all the rain gauges were still in place, so they downloaded the data and changed batteries that were low on juice after the cold winter months. The equipment they installed will monitor the sites for the next 5 years, noting real-time rainfall, unless, of course, everything gets taken out by a debris flow. Sitting barefoot in their front yards in May, amid lilac bushes and daisies, Grotto residents expressed their concerns. "We have to cross our fingers," Lorenzo Vasquez said. "We're screwed for mudslides." Richard Walther, his neighbor, agreed. They're worried that debris flows could reroute the creek between their homes and mountainside, causing flooding or road damage. The Washington Geological Survey scientists hope their work will help residents prepare in the future. "We would like to be able to tell people, this is your peak risk," Mickelson says. "We just don't know that yet." Next, 8 Books That Explain How the World Works by Chelsea Liu. Maybe this sounds familiar. You've stared idly through an airplane's window and wondered, how exactly does that jet engine work? Or you've tracked a shipment from across the country, refreshing UPS's website, and realized you have no idea how that package will actually make its way to your door. Or you've been notified that you must boil your tap water for an overnight loss of pressure without knowing what that means or why it's affecting you. Modern society has been shaped by and depends on many complex interlocked systems: GPS, the internet, transoceanic shipping. But even the most tech-savvy person might struggle to get a handle on every detail. And these technological advances come with a strange caveat. The more fundamental and seamless the arrangement is, the less we think about how it operates. As a result, we take our infrastructure for granted, at least until a massive ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal or a Florida condo building suddenly collapses. The books on our list below explain our world with much-needed clarity, exposing how marvels such as skyscrapers, computer chips, and the global supply chain are put together. As a group, they also make the case that paying attention to how each works is more important than ever, as pandemics and climate change threaten the smooth performance we've come to expect. Understanding every aspect of our globalized lives may not be realistic, but these books make the attempt much less daunting. First, Built by Roma Agrawal. Structural engineers develop a kind of X-ray vision that enables them to see the sturdy skeleton holding up a building, Agrawal writes. Her book briefly grants that superpower to even the least technically inclined. A designer of bridges, apartment buildings, and skyscrapers, including London's striking Shard, Agrawal outlines the structure, how the structures handle gravity and the unpredictable effects of wind, earthquakes, and other forces in order to actually stay up, bundling her explanations with helpful hand-drawn diagrams. We learn why reinforced concrete, which contains a network of steel rods, is so strong, and admire modern feats of engineering, the massive pendulum atop the Taipei 101 skyscraper, which decreases sway, the ingenious tubular design of the Burj Khalifa. But Agrawal focuses just as enthusiastically on structures decades or centuries old. She explains why the Pantheon's concrete dome remains standing despite the crushing forces acting on it, admires brick arches in Pompeii, and retells the dramatic construction of the Brooklyn Bridge, primarily overseen by Emily Warren Roebling after her husband again became too ill to complete the work. Agrawal's perspective invites us to look more closely at the many buildings, both awe-inspiring and humble, around us. 2. The Perfectionist by Simon Winchester. The Perfectionist dramatically explores the history of engineers figuring out how to manufacture things, mostly out of metal, glass, or other hard materials, into exacting shapes and sizes, making possible our world of cars, jet engines, and microprocessor chips. The story begins and is intimately bound up with the Industrial Revolution. John Wilkinson, one of the fathers of precision engineering, devised snug-fitting cylinders for James Watt's steam engine, and the early days of the discipline are similarly full of delightfully specific historical objects. Pulleys made for British naval ships, for example, and the fiddly bits of flintlock muskets. But as Winchester steps through the great advancements that pushed this school of engineering to new extremes, he makes clear that we now rely on machines to achieve a perfection unattainable by people, and that this comes with hefty stakes. An improperly machined oil pipe, for instance, caused catastrophic engine failure in a 2010 Qantas flight because it was about a half a millimeter too thin, he writes. Perhaps he suggests the deeper respect for imperfect craftsmanship might live alongside our reverence for mechanical technique. 3. How Infrastructure Works by Deb Chachra. In its first chapter, How Infrastructure Works makes an earnest attempt to define what exactly infrastructure is. All of the stuff that you don't think about turns out to be a surprisingly good starting point, Chachra writes. The networks that provide electricity, heat, water, sewage treatment, and internet to our homes, plus the roads, public transit, aviation, and GPS that allow us to traverse the world, are hidden from view and seem strikingly complicated when they are visible. But reliable access to these systems defines a fluent contemporary life. When they fail, the result is, as Chachra puts it, recognizably dystopian. Consider the February 2021 electrical outages in Texas for just one bleak example. Rather than offering nitty-gritty explanations of how a power grid operates, though, this book articulates something of a philosophy of infrastructure, both a convincing call for us to think harder about these systems and a roadmap for how we might do so productively, particularly as climate change threatens to destabilize our aging public works. Chachra's vision is positive, even galvanizing. I came away hopeful about a future powered by renewable energy and determined to pay closer attention to what we might transform to make that future real. 4. The Way Things Work by David McCauley. The Way Things Work is a classic children's reference book full of lavish color illustrations laying out fundamental scientific concepts and interspersed with dryly funny journal entries from a fictional alternate universe in which woolly mammoths were domesticated. But I am firmly convinced that most adults would find this book more informative, revealing, and downright useful than a child would. I had a copy of my own as a kid and remember it as both alluring and totally impenetrable, because I had no idea what a combine harvester and a car's clutch were. Diagrams on every page lay bare the inner workings of an array of devices. Small objects, CFL light bulbs, drill bits, batteries, are blown up to huge proportions and often illustrated with tiny people at their bases. Big things like towers and oil rigs and telecommunication networks are shrunk down to digestible size. You'll learn facts that will let you approach the material world with a curious and more discerning eye. And if you're anything like me, you will find it incredibly humbling to realize that even toasters operate based on principles you could previously barely follow, not to mention the technologies such as end-to-end encryption, touchscreens, and the LiDAR units on self-driving cars that the book's newer editions cover. Book number 5, Arriving Today, by Christopher Mims. Modern supply chains are so convoluted, Mims informs us, that an average smartphone might include parts that have traveled through at least 5 countries before it even reaches its user's hand. Each component could tell more stories than could be explored in a lifetime. His book unravels these long, winding journeys through the example of a hypothetical USB charger that someone has ordered on Amazon, starting from a Vietnamese factory that assembles the device and ending on an American doorstep. It's a vivid and occasionally outrage-inducing look at the systems and people involved in getting us our stuff. The author rides along with harbor pilots who maneuver container ships in and out of ports, and truck drivers who forego sleep and personal relationships in order to haul enough loads to make themselves a meager living. Along the way are forays into the industry's history and its future. Mims explains how the shipping container became ubiquitous in part because of the Vietnam War, and investigates the continued role of robots and algorithms in shaping how goods are made and delivered. He focuses in particular on Amazon, where blue-collar workers are already forced to match the blistering pace set by machines. So much of what happens in an Amazon fulfillment center is relevant to the entire $5.5 trillion supply chain and logistics industry, he writes, because, in a way, it's the future of it all. 6. The Master Switch, by Tim Wu. Wu's book centers on 5 technologies that have transformed the way we share information: telephones, radio, film, TV, and the internet. But beyond focusing on the stirring technical wizardry of their invention, he also explores what happened after, as each technology hit the American market and entire industries sprouted up around them. The history is shaped by monopoly power, as the owners of established technologies in the 20th century actively sought to crush or control any spark of innovation that threatened their dominance. He explains that AT&T, a successor to the 19th century Bell Telephone Company, was especially guilty of this. These forces of monopoly and resistance drive what Wu calls the cycle, in which these industries shift between periods of openness that nurture scrappy upstarts, such as the utopian beginnings of radio and cable television, and an inexorable closing and consolidation, the 3-network TV ecosystem of NBC, CBS, and ABC, the centralized Hollywood studio structure that fell prey to the restrictive Hays Code. Whether the internet would adhere to the cycle is, by the book's end, an open question. The specifics may have changed since 2010, when The Master Switch was first published, but the historical framework of the book provides, that the book provides, is still invaluable to helping us to think clearly about today's tech and media giants. And lastly, number seven book is Flying Blind by Peter Robeson. In 2018 and 2019, 346 people died in 2 crashes of malfunctioning Boeing 737 MAX 8 planes. Robeson's investigation into the tragedies asks, how did one of the most respected engineering companies in America produce such fatally flawed aircraft? This account covers the long arc of Boeing history and places the blame squarely on the corporate culture that arose after a merger in the late 1990s, which focused on enriching shareholders at the expense of careful engineering. Over the 737 MAX 8's development, cost-cutting fixes piled up with agonizing implications. Not only had Boeing's employees created software that resulted in control being wrested from the pilots because of a frequently faulty instrument signals, they also deleted, relevant parts of the plane's flight manual, and maintained that expensive flight simulator training wasn't necessary for the new aircraft. What makes the account riveting, though, and blood-boiling, is Robeson's attention to the stories of the victims and their grieving families. Reading them, one ends up emotionally invested in the workings of commercial aviation, and freshly aware of the great complexity and responsibility underlying an industry that so many of us depend on to work, travel, and to see distant loved ones. Our third article today, One Huge Contradiction is Undoing Our Best Climate Efforts, by Zoe Schlanger. You'd be forgiven for thinking that the fight against climate change is finally going well. The clean energy revolution is well underway and exceeding expectations. Solar is set to become the cheapest form of energy in most places by 2030, and the remarkable efficiency of heat pumps is driving their own uptake now. Sales of electric vehicles could surpass those of gas-burning cars in the next 6 years. The world's biggest powers are putting huge sums toward infrastructure to usher in some form of energy transformation. Pledges are being made, legislation is being passed. The world, it seems, is finally lurching in the right direction. But none of that is enough, practically speaking, because of one enormous hitch. The world is still using more energy each year, our consumption ticking ever upward, swallowing any gains made by renewable energy. Emissions are still rising, more slowly than they used to, but nonetheless rising. Instead of getting pushed down, the needle is fitfully jiggling above zero, clawing into positive digits when it needs to be deeply pitched into the negative. We are, in other words, simply not making a dent. And so we are now in climate purgatory. In this zone, countries and companies are doing the right thing to steer away from the damages of climate change, but are at the very same time making deliberate choices that swamp the effect of those other better things. The International Energy Agency predicts that demand for fossil fuels will peak by 2030. Yet a report released by the United Nations and several climate organizations this week found that governments in aggregate still plan to increase coal production until 2030 and oil and gas production until at least 2050. Global net zero agreements be damned. In total, countries that hold the world's oil, gas, and coal deposits still plan to produce 69% more fossil fuels than is compatible with keeping warming under 2 degrees Celsius, the riskier cousin to the 1.5 degrees Celsius goal each of the countries pledged to aim for. Many experts now consider that goal impossible because of global reluctance to phase out fossil fuels. One expert who worked on a UN report called this insanity, a climate disaster of our own making. The climate math is not adding up. The scientist James Hansen, famous for his early warnings about climate change, suggested in a paper recently with a suite of high-level colleagues that warming is accelerating more rapidly than is presently understood. In their view that the Earth could exceed 1.5 degrees of warming this decade is practically assured, and 2 degrees by 2050 is likely, unless the world eliminates fossil fuel use far faster than planned. These new calculations are a reflection of just how many variables go into making the livable conditions we call the climate, and how messing with one, even with good intentions, can have cascading effects. Part of the problem, these researchers found, was that regulations passed to reduce harmful sulfate aerosol emissions from shipping vessels worked. Sulfate aerosols are bad for human health. They also reflect solar radiation back into space, so less pollution also means that the Earth is absorbing that much more energy and heating up that much faster. That's why global warming will accelerate. That's why global melting will accelerate, Hansen said at a press conference. Some fellow climate scientists found the paper's exact predictions questionable, calling them almost too alarmist and arguing that the temperature will take a bit longer to change. But even if researchers disagree on the details, their worry over our climate future is apparent. Their usual tone of reserve is melting away. typical circumspect scientists are beginning to sound desperate, the despair leaking out in the exhortations to the public to take climate change for the emergency it is. They are publicly mourning the species they study, the emperor penguin scientist facing down the loss of her subjects, the coral reef scientist recognizing that no reef is safe from bleaching. One climate scientist called recent global temperature data absolutely gobsmackingly bananas. Whichever way you cut it, global warming is already happening too fast to generously support life, which our prior climate did quite well. Emissions tick up, global temperatures tick up, and the consequences unfold. Caitlin Naughton, an ocean ice modeler for the British Antarctic Survey, co-authored a paper in the journal Nature Climate Change last month, warning that the loss of much of West Antarctica's ice sheet is now virtually inevitable. Even if future emissions were drastically curtailed, enough warming is probably locked in to wash the bulk of the sheet away. At best, she says, we are on the brink of the total loss becoming assured. The exact timing is unclear, but one estimate, the West Antarctic ice sheet contains enough water to raise sea level globally by just over 5 meters or 17 feet. At the very least, Naughton told me, she thinks that would be wise to plan for 2 to 3 meters of sea level rise, or 6 to 10 feet in the next couple of centuries. We already have a refugee crisis. I shudder to think what would happen if everyone living within 2 meters of sea ice would be displaced, she added. That everyone is projected to include some 410 million people by 2100. France, Ireland, Kenya, Spain, and 12 other countries have called for a global accord to phase out fossil fuel production. There is little doubt that this is necessary. Yet in the U.S. alone, a country responsible for at least 20% of historical emissions, the current build-out of liquefied natural gas infrastructure intended to export the country's plentiful gas is the largest fossil fuel expansion proposed in the world. And it's happening under a president who recently passed the most impactful climate legislation the country has ever seen. That climate math isn't adding up. Policy represents the choices that our leaders make about when to finally change course. Naughton, the Antarctic ice scientist, reminded me that climate is a spectrum. It isn't an on-off switch. Whenever we do make a different set of decisions, ones that make the math properly compute, we will be saving what we have left, preventing some layer of livability from being irrecoverably sloughed off and swept away. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.